One, two, three, four.
When capitalism stops serving the needs of the people, what can we do to create a fairer, more equitable society? What can we learn from China's success and economic growth? Are we witnessing the decline of the American empire? And what comes next?
Richard D. Wolff is the co-founder of Democracy at Work and host of their nationally syndicated show, Economic Update. He was formerly professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, Yale University, the City College of the City University of New York, and the University of Paris Sorbonne. Currently, Wolff is a visiting professor in the graduate program in international affairs of the New School University in New York City.
Professor Richard Wolff, welcome back to the Creative Process and One Planet podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So, you know, it's hard to make forecasts looking down the barrel of a second Trump presidency, a man who prides himself on saying two things at once and meaning neither of them. But taking into account things as they stand, we can see the cracks in the American empire. There are certain facts. Already the world's richest 1%, they've already used up their fair share of their global carbon budget for 2025. BRICS nations have expanded and are now 50% of the world's population, compared to the US's 4.2% and the G7's 10%. America, of course, owes Japan $1.1 trillion and owes China $859 billion. And then there's the war in Ukraine and Gaza that have cost lives, money, and credibility of the US around the world. And on the other side, you have Trump, who was elected, who had 77 million people vote him into office, who says climate change is a hoax. His fast new friend, Elon Musk of the X platform, has 210 million followers. Zuckerberg's Meta has 1.4 billion daily users and has now removed fact checkers from its platform. So all told, that's 1.7 billion people these three men can sway, which has massive potential for persuasion and influence at a time when we need facts and not vitriol. And on the climate front, 2024 was the hottest year on record. So how do you choose which areas to turn your attention to when all of these problems are clearly out of control?
Yes, so what unifies, in a sense, what lies behind all of these is the prioritization of profit over everything else. So because it's profitable to build housing in unsafe areas, we do it. We pay the price, if you like, because it's profitable. We turn against our allies around the world because it appears to a politician to be a profitable gamblet to pay. So where others would be eager to sustain an alliance, our political leader currently thinks it's fun and profitable to him as a vote collector to enact a theater of Mr. Tough Guy. It's all theater. The position of the United States in the world, economically and politically, is the weakest it has been in my lifetime. I was born in the middle of the 20th century, so I have watched the rise of the American empire and the success of American capitalism in the second half of the 20th century. But over the last 20 years, I have watched that turn into a decline. And the decline is visible everywhere unless you live in the United States and you consume mainstream media where there is a level of denial that will be recorded historically as one of the great examples, not just of a declining empire, which typically has people who can't face it, who refuse to see it. You can go to Great Britain today and find people, quite a few, who think we still have the British Empire, even though everyone who isn't crazy knows that that's silly. But we are earlier in the decline phase than the British are. They've had to do it for a century. We've just had to do it for a couple of decades. And so it is fresh. And we still have political leaders, as, for example, in the presidential election just behind us, in which neither Mr. Trump nor the Democrats, either of them, who ran against him, ever said a word about a declining empire. They outdid each other in pretending otherwise. It's extraordinary. You don't solve problems by denying them. Your doctor makes that point to you every time you visit. Your psychiatrist, your therapist, your boyfriend, your girlfriend. You need to face the issues that shape your life. They're not going to go away all by themselves. And yet that's the way this society is dealing with the fire in Los Angeles or each of the other problems.
And yet, as you say, it's kind of coded within campaigns by scapegoating immigrants. These are signs of economic weakness rather than economic strength. If you were to have such a thriving economy as the United States in the past, in early parts in the 20th century, we wanted immigration because we needed to supply goods. Everything was thriving healthy so we could welcome and absorb them.
Right. And look at that as an example. It is a weakness that we can't absorb them. The jobs that we don't have to give, the housing to build, the taxes that they pay and that we need as a society. We can't do it. We can't absorb them. That is a sign, if we were rational, that we have to really ask questions about our economy, that it is weak in this way. We don't do it. Instead, we fight a war in Ukraine, thousands of miles away from us, no threat to us at all in any foreseeable future, one way or another. And we are complicit in levels of horror in Gaza that make you have to wonder what happened to all of the so-called commitments to solving problems in a reasonable way. The justification of killing huge numbers of innocent people is a justification we're supposed to reject. The end doesn't justify the means. These are the slogans of the Cold War used by the United States against the Soviet Union. And now they apply to us, and we still don't ask the question as a nation, what is happening here?
So you discuss the kind of, we have to diagnose it like a patient. What is the underlying problem? You know, this system based on exploitation. You know, what is capitalism and why is it not serving the average worker of the population?
Well, I think the model of that is the production system. I mean, we are shaped in our thinking, in our interpersonal relationships, and so on, by the way we organize the fundamental production of the goods and services we depend on. And if you organize every factory, office, or store with a handful of people at the top, who have all the power, the board of directors, the senior executives, the owner, that 3% of our people that are employers, if they're the ones who have all the power and they aggregate into their hands the stupefying wealth we read about every day, well, then we have a society that is organized around a handful of people at the top, a tiny percentage of the people, making the basic economic and therefore political decisions. You know, Mr. Musk can decide with a stroke of the pen where billions of dollars go. Will they be used to produce another spaceship? Or will they be used to provide basic education to people who can't afford it now? That's a fundamentally political question. But we allow it to be made by that individual. That is crazy. It's not sustainable anywhere in the world, and the proof is it never has been sustained. It can last a long time, but what we also see is it accumulates levels of opposition that will eventually blow it up, and I think we're living through exactly that situation right now.
The recent election said it's for the people. It's making all these promises. It's supposed to be securing jobs. And yet it's doing the very opposite. I mean, really paying for votes on an individual basis to continue, whether it's favorable tariffs from Musk and Tesla against electric vehicles from China, which are cheaper and is good quality or even better. You know, that's not sustainable too. But, you know, there's a ripple effect. You think that you're kind of holding at bay certain products that should stand up within a functioning free market economy. But then there's a ripple effect because if people and companies can't access those reasonably priced goods, that affects all these other kinds of businesses. So it's a kind of false economy, right?
Yes. And that makes you wonder, right? Because capitalists are not stupid. They have the same mental capacity the rest of us do. So they know that if the best electric vehicle in the world is made in China, which it is, by something called the BYD Corporation, those are being purchased in the millions all over the world by companies that compete with American firms. American firms cannot access the best, cheapest electric vehicle because the United States government puts 100% tariff on them as we speak. That means you have to settle for a less good, more expensive domestic product. And in the long run, that's competitively disadvantageous to Americans. The joke is, what you do may be good for the American producers of electric vehicles, because they don't have that Chinese competition to worry about. You've excluded it by means of a tariff. That's good for them, but it's at the expense of every other capitalist who buys electric vehicles as an input. This is self-destructive. The irony is, and if I could quote good old Karl Marx, capitalism is undone not by a force that comes in from the outside. Capitalism is undone because it does that to itself.
Yeah, it was all predicted so long ago. So what can we learn from China's success? I mean, their economic model, it's unparalleled, what they've done in 70 years with four times the population of the U.S., the kind of economic growth, it just dwarfs ours continually for at least the last 20 years. And I think with great humility, they learned with their socialist, capitalist two systems from the failures of the U.S. system, from the failures of the Soviet Union. And with humility, what could we learn from them?
Well, if we had some humility, which I would say these days in the United States is in very short supply, here's what I think a reasonable person would say. We have had over the last century a direct, concrete experience with a governmentally controlled capitalism. And I say capitalism because of the use of this model of a few people at the top making the decisions for a mass of people. In the Soviet Union, you had a relatively small number of people in the government, in the apparatus of the state, with the Communist Party and so on, making the decisions for a mass of the working class. So it's capitalist. In that way, it's like the United States. The difference is you give the state the dominant position in the Soviet Union, and you give private capitalists the dominant position in the United States, the United Kingdom, and so on. Now, what is China? China is a refusal to do either of these two, not to do the Soviet Union, which is remarkable because they began as a project of the Soviet Union, as an ally. But they broke in the 1960s, very dramatic part of Chinese history. They broke from the Soviet Union and developed their own plan. And it's not to be a Soviet state system, and it's not to be a US-UK private system. It is to be a carefully curated hybrid, roughly 50% private capitalist, both Chinese and non-Chinese, and 50% state, and the whole thing supervised by a very powerful Communist Party. Okay, those are three alternative models. And I would like to remind my pragmatic, and I mean that in the philosophic sense, my pragmatic friends, that it's rare in history to be in a moment where we have three roughly contemporaneous experiments in three different ways of developing a capitalist system. And one of them developed faster in the worst possible conditions than the other two. China, as you rightly point out, in the last 40 years has done more in the way of developing its way out of poverty than the United States and the United Kingdom could do in centuries. Any humility, not governed by either anti-Soviet or anti-communist or old Cold War mentality, any reasonably open human being would have to say, we have a lot to learn from what the Chinese did. Doesn't mean you have to copy it. It doesn't mean that you can't make criticisms and reject this or that aspect of China. This is not a silly argument. This is an argument they showed pragmatically what they can do. Over the last 20 years, automobile companies around the country have been competing on who could develop the electric car and truck the furthest, the quickest. Mr. Musk was the first, but he's turned out not to be the best, which is not at all unusual. The Chinese have outdone him. Okay, we learn from that. And what you learn is not to demonize what they achieved, but to learn from it. And by the way, despite all of the anti-Chinese noise being fomented, American companies, European companies, politicians, they are in fact looking at the Chinese for a model. That's why you're seeing a bigger and bigger role for the state, both in Europe and in North America, grudgingly pretending otherwise, giving lip service to private enterprise. They are in fact going where they know the future now lies. And we're going to have a great denouement, the French would call it, when it is finally understood and can be spoken that we are copying much of what the Chinese have achieved because it's the rational thing to do.
And there's no shame in it. And I should say, it's not just what China has done for China. I mean, their approach to diplomacy around the world and having this long view of understanding that they would need mineral rights for all these new technologies and investing in Africa and elsewhere. I mean, people don't want to be bombed into obeisance. They like their roads to be built. They want access to water. They want hospitals. They don't care who's doing it. But that's a much better way than having military bases all around the world, in my opinion.
Yes, and I think the Chinese have been quite open to learning from the rest of the world. Long before the Civil War in the 1940s, China was famous for opening up and looking to the West. I remember in the early 20th century, sending Chinese young people to Western Europe to take university courses and to get the wisdom of the West and bring it to the East. So I think you can expect the Chinese will borrow from the United States all kinds of procedures, civil liberties, civil rights that may not exist now in China, but are wanted by the Chinese people, and they will find ways to get them. The chances of that happening are much greater if we are honestly, with some humility, learning from each other than if we are rattling sabers. Every time I read about the American fleet in the South China Sea, or yet another iteration of the tired old Taiwan issue, my goodness, it's almost as though, and this is how it looks in the European press, that the United States is looking for issues to fight with the Chinese about. And I'm hopeful that the new generation is finding the old people that are leading the Western countries more and more out of touch, behaving in ways that do not inspire confidence. There's a reason that Mr. Starmer in England is already at low levels of popularity copying Mr. Macron in France, or the recently ousted Scholz in Germany. People should remember that one of the reasons the Trump administration has to keep talking about the mandate he got in the election is because he didn't get a mandate in the election. 1.5% is the difference between the popular vote for him and the popular vote for Kamala Harris. You know, a tiny percentage of our people, if they had voted the other way, we would have a different government. And what that means is roughly half the people don't want you. And this is going to make his government difficult. The kinds of people he has brought in at top positions, half of them are committed to destroying the department they have been put in charge of. This is a bizarre dynamic. And most of all, I would urge people, what's going to happen in the next 4 years? Is 90% determined by forces over which Mr. Trump has no control. And that's not unique to him. That was true for Mr. Biden. That was true for Mr. Trump the first time. True for Bush. True for Clinton. True for Obama. All of them. We Americans have a deluded notion that the world revolves around us. And for a while, it did, which made this delusion really. The second half of the 20th century was bizarre. We have to know our own history. Every other competing power, Britain, France, Germany, Japan, Russia, was decimated in World War II. We were not. One day bombs fell in Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. Other than that, no bombs. Nothing was destroyed here. We suffered fewer casualties than any of the other combatant countries. We emerged top of the hill with no competitors. The dollar was the global currency. American military bases ringed the world. We had a level of dominance that, of course, was historically anomalous. That doesn't happen. And when it does, it never lasts. Never, for thousands of years. That would have been the first thing Americans should have understood. Instead, they made the classic childish mistake. They imagined it could last forever. And so Republicans and Democrats blame each other for the fact that neither of them could do what nobody ever could do, what isn't doable. And you know what we're living through? The denouement, the coming to terms. Just to give you one example. Last week, one of the largest countries in the world, Indonesia, a population of 280 million people, joined the BRICS. It's one more chapter. It's one more nail in the coffin of the American empire. And it got no attention, no publicity, no examination. It's as if we can make it disappear by not looking at it. Childish denial, self-destructive is where that ends up. Mr. Trump is not a political scientist. The people around him are not, I'm being as polite as I can be. They are not great or deep thinkers. So what does it mean that the conservative party, the Republicans, whose major issue for the last century has been lower taxes, moronic in its lopsidedness, but leave that for the moment. What does it mean that they turn out to produce a government, Mr. Trump's, whose priority is to come to some agreement with Mr. Putin in Russia? There it is. There is the American anti-Russian, anti-communist dissolving internally. Russia didn't make the position of Mr. Trump change. Mr. Trump saw a political advantage. If you follow him, his early formulations were not so much about Russia and Ukraine, but that he was going to end the forever wars, a phrase he developed. Well, who's in favor of it? The Democrats. Yeah, but forever wars, which is a fair assessment, used to be called principled pro-democracy, anti-communism. You can't sustain that story anymore. Now the conservatives are leading the way in making Mr. Putin a reasonable person. I just learned yesterday that they've already discussed an important meeting between Mr. Trump and Mr. Putin as a priority in the early weeks of his presidency. Okay, that's a small moment in a changing mentality, because it isn't working. I don't mean to upset people, but let's be honest. The war in Vietnam, the United States was defeated. It fought against the Communist Party of North and South Vietnam, and the emerging victor was the Communist Party of North and South Vietnam, which has governed that country ever since. The United States lost. In Afghanistan, the United States set out to destroy and defeat the Taliban. But Afghanistan is today ruled by the Taliban. The United States was defeated. In Iraq, it was defeated. In Ukraine, I understand Americans are in denial, but everywhere else in the world, it's crystal clear that the United States has been defeated. Okay, you can have a few of these. And let me tell you, as a professor, as I go around the United States giving talks, often to college students, when I lean across the podium and I come to that part of my story where I talk about the defeat of the United States, you should see their faces. This is the first time someone has said that to them. They don't think Americans lose wars, any of them. That's a level of self-delusion that will come back to haunt you, because you're going to make terrible strategic mistakes. The idea in Washington that you could defeat Russia in the Ukraine by a program of economic sanctions, on top of the military. That was a terrible mistake. It didn't understand that Russia could turn to its BRICS allies, above all China and India, and sell the oil and gas to them that the Europeans will no longer buy, hoping thereby to cripple Russia. It failed. Russia's economic growth is better than Europe's for the last 2 or 3 years. It's a grotesque miscalculation, but it should be a warning. The level of self-delusion you have is leading you into terribly self-destructive miscalculations.
So it's very interesting because I heard you say that in terms of China considering its empire and whether it should be an empire, learning from the mistakes, as you say, empires all decline. So learning from its mistakes, it seems to perhaps take a different direction.
Yes. I like to teach this point by means of a historical parallel. The United States was a colony of Britain, and Britain at that time was a monarchy. When the United States decided to break away, fought the American Revolution at the end of the 18th century, and again in the War of 1812 and 1815, two wars, it too had a path. It could decide to be an independent feudal monarchy, and that would have led them to make it King George Washington. But they didn't do that. They wanted to break not just from the English feudal monarchy, but from monarchy too. And they wanted to make it a democratic republic, which they did. Okay, the Chinese are in the same position. They are now going to have to decide two fundamental questions. And this is the agenda for them, which history has given them. Number one, they are the inheritors of the British and American empires. Those empires are over. The British very much so, and the Americans well on their way. So the Chinese could emerge as the next empire. But given what we know about what empires cost, and given what we know about what empires cause, the Chinese are very clear, and they're talking about it, that they have an alternative path. They could actually be a society that chooses not to replicate the past, the way the Americans chose not to replicate their past in a feudal monarchy. They could decide to really support multinational global power structures, not to have 700 military bases around the world the way the United States did, or not to have an empire upon which the sun never set, as the British like to say. But they have also a second choice to make, because they are a Communist Party-led society. And if you read Karl Marx's work, and he remains to this day the greatest contributor to that tradition of criticism of capitalism, Marx made it very clear in his great work, Capital, Volume 1. Right there he says there is an alternative. You don't have to have a tiny group of people at the top of every enterprise making all the decisions. You could collectively own and operate an enterprise. That's why I'm an advocate of worker co-ops, because that's the modern version of what Marx was talking about. And if all the workers in an enterprise, each one of them had a vote and could decide collectively what the enterprise is going to do, they would be aware of all the issues that the working people always are aware of, and they would want their enterprises to address those problems. They would never allow a tiny group of people and their income from the enterprise to determine what the enterprise does. Profit would not be their priority. And therein lies the question. Is China willing to go in that direction? And we don't know the answer to that. We still don't know the answer to the empire versus multilateral. But those issues are probably going to be decided in China before they go anywhere else.
According to Dr. Wolf, the American empire stands on the same shifting ground that eventually topples every great power. He points to the historical record. From the Roman Empire to Great Britain, no one holds the crown forever. Yet we continue to persuade, or rather, delude ourselves into believing in America's eternal greatness. Which makes me wonder, if the lessons of history say all things must pass, Why do we insist on not us? Today, that question feels especially complicated. Even as we refuse to confront history's prophecies, political rhetoric is overflowing with references to the past. Ideas like manifest destiny and big stick imperialism are reappearing in policy discussions, harkening back to the good old days of US expansionism. Meanwhile, in popular culture, we're seeing a surge in big budget movies revisiting nostalgic material. Think the Barbie movie, or Wicked, or Disney's live action remakes of princess classics. Everywhere we turn, a billboard-sized directive tells us to look back, yet the fine print is easy to miss. These calls subtly acknowledge that America isn't as great as it used to be. Otherwise, why keep saying again? Invoking a mythic golden age is simply more palatable than facing uncomfortable truths head on. But politics and pop culture do more than simply create the illusion of a prodigal return. They also promise progress through a revision of the past. Take the Barbie movie, for instance. It attempts to modernize a controversial symbol of womanhood by embracing more inclusive ideas about race and gender. More striking still, it positions Barbie, and by extension, the Barbie franchise itself, as the driving force behind this transformation. In effect, the brand that once perpetuated problematic female stereotypes is now cast as the antidote to them. It's a clever marketing strategy that taps into our desire for social change. If you want inclusivity, just buy a Barbie. No structural upheaval necessary. The film might as well have been called Make Barbie Great Again. A similar logic applies to political slogans that repurpose old expansionist rhetoric for contemporary goals. The very system that fueled the need for change is now portrayed as its own progressive remedy. As voters, as consumers, we purchase into the idea that not only is the past super great, but that for the small price of a ballot or a movie ticket, it can be revisited, repaired, and ultimately improved. We can return to the golden age without having to lift a finger towards dismantling the underlying structures that led us astray in the first place. Yet by clinging to these revisionary snapshots of America's golden years, we insulate ourselves from the broader lessons of world history. As Wolf suggests, the United States, like the empires before it, marches steadily towards decline, and no curated vision of the past can forestall that reality. So we return to our original question. Why insist on America's everlasting greatness when the evidence points elsewhere? After all, if we truly believed in this greatness, we wouldn't need to keep reassuring ourselves. Nor would we bankroll an entire film industry that peddles nostalgia for a Proustian lost time. Perhaps, deep down, we already sense that America's best days are behind her. Perhaps we know that in the end, nothing gold can stay. And now, back to the interview.
So, I guess in perhaps partial response to the question of why we continue accepting a system that runs on the exploitation of laborers, you've discussed the strength of desires like wanting to be our own boss, for instance. But while these desires appear to be pro-capitalist, you also argue that they actually emerge from an underlying critique of capitalism itself. So my question is, how has capitalism managed to repackage itself as the answer to the very desires that could undermine it?
Well, here's the way I would answer. If you organize a society such that a tiny group of people have a disorienting amount of power relative to the mass, that Elon Musk has a personal wealth now of $400 billion, while the majority of Americans really agonize over whether they can afford a college education for their kids. These levels of inequality, inequality of power, inequality of wealth, have always meant in human history the desperate, urgent need for the rich and the powerful to control the unrich and the unpowerful, because they understand better than anybody how vulnerable they are. You know, a slight shift of votes, and we could have in the United States a politics that says we're going to tax everybody's wealth who has more than a billion, we'll take it. We'll tax them. Could be done in 10 minutes. There's no problem here. They know that. So they spend an enormous amount of effort. This is so important, folks. They spend an enormous amount of effort to persuade the mass of people that the current system is the best you can hope for, is the only one that's viable, and that anyone who is critical or oppositional is either crazy or evil or both. And they work at it night and day. I can speak to you personally. I went to the most prestigious universities the United States has. I went to Harvard, Stanford, and Yale. 10 years of my life spent going through those universities. And throughout my time, I was bombarded by professors, some good, some bad, some in the middle. But they all had one thing to tell me. This is the best system the human being can achieve. You are very lucky to be here. And if you're critical, there's something wrong with you. Oh, you can be critical of this detail or that one. But wow, we are the best. They really worked hard. And some of them were very good at it. They tried. And I was a good student. I was brought up by mommy and daddy, and they told me my job in school is to be successful, to do that which gets me an A rather than a B. So I'm a docile kid, like everybody else, but they never persuaded me. Never. I listened. I took notes. I was a dutiful kid. But the realities I was living through clashed with what they were telling me. And when I brought that up, they didn't handle it well. They didn't have good answers. But more than that, I could see in their eyes, and some of them actually said it to me, don't bring up those questions. That'll get you into trouble, and it'll get me as the teacher into trouble. Don't do it. And I'm a sensitive person. I didn't want to make life unpleasant. My teachers were perfectly reasonable people most of the time. And so I backed off and I kept it inside. But I'm one of millions in this country. I can assure you, as I go around talking, I'm constantly amazed by how many people understand what I have to say. Because one of the ways people like me have been kept down is by being told, nobody else thinks the way you do. You're odd. You're weird. That's a game. Don't believe it. It's never been true. Capitalism has always had its critics. Karl Marx isn't the only one. He depended on those who came before him, as those of us who come later depend in part on him. That's the way this goes. And eventually, the contradiction between the realities we live with that we have to navigate to get by in our lives will clash with the ideological effort to keep control, and then it's over. The leader of the revolution in Russia is famous, perhaps more for the following quotation than for any other. And I'm talking about Vladimir Lenin, the head of the Russian Revolution. He was approached by his colleagues in the revolutionary movement before 1917, and they whined and they complained, and they said, in a way like your question, why is it taking so long? Why is it so hard for people to understand what we need to do? We need to get a better system. Lenin's answer was, for decades, nothing seems to happen. And then, in a few weeks, decades happen. That's the answer. I know it's frustrating. Believe me. You're coming, you, the younger of the two of you, you're coming at a time when the change is going to be fast. I had to live through a time when the change was deferred, was elongated. The timing was not anything we were responsible for, obviously. But I understand the wisdom of Mr. Lenin, because I got to tell you, for 40 years before 2010, I would be invited to do a radio or television interview once every 2 or 3 months. I do 3 to 4 radio and television interviews every day. You are my first. I have 3 more today. And that's not because of me. I'm not singing a different tune. But the American people are finding this tune interesting. And so my life has completely, completely changed. I teach a course at the New School University here in New York City. But I do that because I like the act of teaching. Otherwise, I can't justify it because I've got 20, 30 students. And when I go on television, I have millions. Having had no audience most of my life, beyond being a professor, now my public audience is overwhelming. People stop me on the street and are gracious and say thank you. Very flattering. Blows your ego right out of the water. But the wonderful thing about it is they're figuring it out. They like what I say, but it's because they figured out on their own enough so that what I have to say means something to them at this point. They're gratified, in a sense, to hear it, to see it. Maybe I can point out something they hadn't themselves figured out. But they're already there. And that's the best news of all.
Your various platforms, Democracy at Work, Economic Update, your books, Understanding Capitalism, Understanding Socialism, you speak directly, tell the truth. There's nothing exaggerated. It's all based on fact. And I think this is what is essential. And this is something I didn't get growing up. There are certain basic things that we need going forward. It's an environmental education for an uncertain future and an economic education, a good grounding in finance, just to understand, to help us improve these systems. If people can find their way to you through the classroom or through these other platforms, you really make it clear these things that can be really vague and hard for people to understand.
You know, when I was a little kid and my mother and father asked me, what do you want to be? And I went through the phases, I want to be a cowboy or I want to be a fireman and all those. What I ended up with, and I was still very young, was I wanted to be a teacher. I wanted to give what was it by that time the most exciting thing for me, which was having someone explain to me how it works. There was a sense of mastery, a sense of having at least a little bit of control of your life if you understand why things are happening. That will unfortunately also teach you that you can't control all that much of it. But that little bit that understanding gets you is very valuable. And if you want to give that to people, they get it. They don't know me all that well. Why should they trust me? Why should they think I'm honest? I think it's because I convey what the best of my teachers conveyed to me, that they got a pleasure. They got a sense of joy when they could present something and, you know, the little light bulb went off and the student or whoever it was said, I get it. I think that that is a very revolutionary moment. It's what every revolution needed before it could happen.
So earlier you were discussing this relationship between time and change. And currently now we have, with the rise of AI and more sophisticated technologies, they're accelerating the pace at which economic processes, but generally everything happens. So I was wondering, how should we think about time in relationship to economic change, especially in light of Marx's dialectical materialism and Hegel, but, you know, I'm not sure how much you want to go into that. And then the main question is their pace at which these processes should happen, or there's like an ideal time frame in which these economic changes should happen.
Let me turn the question slightly this way. I love reading Hegel. The language is very unique to that period of German culture. I should explain to you. My first language is German. My mother was born in Berlin, immigrated to the United States. By the way, some of my feelings about migration is I'm the product of two immigrants. I was born in the United States, but that my parents, both of them, were European. My father was French. My mother was German. Why did I love Hegel? Because he gave me an insight that was so radical, at least for me at the time I encountered. I had grown up in the American school system. I went to Harvard. I did well. My parents wanted me to get all A's. I did that. I played the violin in the orchestra, and I played quarterback on a football. I mean, I did it all. Why? Because my parents wanted me to do that. They wanted me to succeed as they understood that. And so I learned in the school system that things are either true or false. That when I got a test score in arithmetic, I either got the right answer or the wrong answer. Hegel is a study in there is no such thing. To spend a lifetime trying to get the right answer misunderstands what thinking is and what it can do. To look for the right answer, this is the way I teach this, is as if I offered a course in what the best way is to capture the elephants in the Berkshires. Berkshires are hills here, Western Massachusetts. And you know why students didn't show up? Because they know that there are no elephants in the Berkshires. Therefore, a course in how to catch them strikes them as a waste of time. Hegel taught me that things can be true and false at the same time. In fact, to expect that, and therefore to know that to understand something, you have to know the boundaries that separate it from what it isn't. Therefore, what it isn't is part of understanding what it is. When you have that in your mind, then when you want to understand capitalism, you have to understand what is it that separates it from everything else. And the minute you have that, you have an else. And now you're going to compare. That's what human beings do. When you see a cat and you see a dog, your brain begins to organize that these are different. And out of that might come a notion, I really like cats, and I don't care much for dogs, or vice versa. That's part of me talks a lot about a few people at the top running the enterprise versus a democratic collective of all the people at an enterprise. I'm teaching people it could be otherwise. It always could be. And it can be now. And it can be in your lifetime. And one of the things you might want to think about is what it would be like to work in a job that was organized in a non-capitalist way, where you were as responsible for making the decisions at the top as you were in doing whatever your particular task was, because you were part of the collective that owns and operates this. You would develop differently as a human being. You would develop capacities you don't now develop. If you're a drone who comes into work, go to sit at that desk, work with that computer, you're going to be a very different person after 5 years than if you were designing how this enterprise is going to evolve. In my case, it took Hegel. Maybe in your case, if the moment is right, we're communicating, you and me, at a moment when this spark can find some dry ground. Bad metaphor in the days of fires at Los Angeles.
Well, thank you, Professor Richard D. Wolff, for all you do to help us understand capitalism, regain agency, understand socialism and what it would mean to finally achieve democracy at work. By identifying problems at the core of these crises, we can create a better tomorrow. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to talk with you.
The creative process is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Virginia Moschetti with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Virginia Moschetti. The creative process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anatolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, please drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.